Thank you for the introduction, Dr. Bissell. All right. So I first want to give you a little introduction on the pathogen itself. Well, the justification is that Xanthomonas, I'm going to be terming it ZAP in my presentation, is a serious disease worldwide of all prunus species. It affects peach, nectarine, almond, cherry, plum, and apricot. It causes premature defoliation, which can lead to weak vigor across the years, not just that same season, unmarketable fruit quality, and an overall decline in production. So here is a confocal image of the stomata and the bacteria going in through there. It's a mobile gram-negative rod bacterium. It was first defined on Japanese plums in Michigan in 1903. Periods of 12 hours of water saturation, high humidity, are essential for it to occur, develop, and spread. And it's favored by warm, sandy, humid, wet, dewy, and windy conditions. It occurs in the eastern USA, however, it's rarely seen in California. But I did get, I think in the Good Fruit Grower that they did indeed see it in California, however, a very small amount. Strategies to control ZAP. Well, first and foremost, to grow in sites, to avoid the sites where there's lots of rain, sandy and windy conditions. But secondly, to grow and maintain healthy trees, because when a tree is stressed, it's going to be more susceptible, even if it is resistant. Thirdly, to apply copper compounds or oxytetracycline antibiotics to effectively try to not let the pathogen move back out after it's overwintered. But the problem is, even if well-timed spray schedules are incorporated, the pathogen still is able to, or can get through, and once it's established in the orchard, it's nearly impossible to control, and it's very hard to control if you have very susceptible varieties. So the solution is to replace susceptible cultivars with highly resistant ones. Now, the University of Arkansas Peach Breeding Program has been breeding for high-quality peaches with ZAP resistance since the 1960s. They have never sprayed to control ZAP. The location is in Clarksville, Arkansas, which is about an hour and a half southeast of the university. It's an ideal environment to select for ZAP because we have very warm, humid spring and summers, which allow inoculation and the spread of the pathogen. So this has enabled Dr. Clark and his predecessor to select against disease. So what I'm going to be talking about first is phenotyping that I performed, and then to follow up on how we're integrating or using the phenotypic data to do marker-assisted breeding. So for 3 years, I was out in the field. Phenotyping, the objective is to differentiate ZAP resistant throughout the program, populations, selections, and cultivars. Data was collected across the entire program using a 0-5 scale. Leaf symptoms were evaluated 3 times throughout the season, May, June, and July. And fruit symptoms were assessed and recorded upon maturity. Pictures were also taken of each genotype for future records. Then in 2014, so I started out at Arkansas, and in the first year I just did field data, but my idea was to do some more specific phenotyping evaluation methods to confirm that there was ideal pressure throughout the field. So we performed a detached leaf bioassay and also a detached fruit bioassay. Yet, let me tell you a little bit how we collected the isolates, cultured, and generated ZAP. So isolation and culturing of ZAP isolates. In the summer of 2013, a committee member of mine and I collected leaf and fruit collection on 7 F1 segregating populations. Seen here, you can see two of those populations. Leaves with high and low severity were collected, and an individual fruit with the high severity was collected. Then we decided to also collect isolates from different locations in the eastern USA and south. In this picture, that one didn't show up, but I'm showing you the 12 different locations we collected from. Dr. Clark was able to get me in contact with all of his colleagues, and they sent leaf tissue, leaf with symptoms. And so in these pictures, it's just showing the average temperature, rainfall, and humidity in those different locations in 2013. And as you can see, it was a very ideal year for collecting the pathogen. Now the steps are isolation of the pathogen, culturing, identification, using an ITS marker and later SSR markers to differentiate the isolates from these different locations, and then to generate the inoculum to use in the leaf assay. So here is a picture of the leaf assay. We used a mix of 8 ZAP strains from Arkansas for one round, and then we used XAP88 from North Carolina. A qualitative scale from 0 to 3 was used, although I did take pictures so we can go and use more quantifying programs. However, I was able to see clearly differences, and so I'm confident in those data, in that data. I also did a detached fruit bioassay with a pin barred of 10 needles charged with the inoculum. Also a needleless syringe that was used for the leaf assay, and sandpaper charged with inoculum, and you can see those three right there. Now, they were incubated in a room that was at about 27 degrees Celsius, and here is just wanted to give you a representation of. This is one F1 population. As you can see, parent 1, 708, is outlined in red, and parent 2, 772, is outlined in yellow. And that's 3 replications there. And you can see from left to right on the bottom is 6 of the seedlings from that population. And it's pretty evident that the individuals that are resistant are getting their resistant alleles from 772, and 772 is the most resistant individual in the program, and it's pretty amazing to see it out in the field. Then I also tried the fruit assay. Didn't work out as well, but that's what science is all about. Alright, next with this phenotypic data, the idea is to incorporate marker-assisted breeding into Dr. Clark's already excellent traditional breeding program. So the objectives are to validate two loci that have been associated with XAP fruit resistance in the U of A program, and then to incorporate these loci in marker-assisted parent selection and seedling selection. Now these two loci were first identified in Dr. Gosick's program using one F2 segregating population, and then they were haplotyped across the rose breed germplasm. And so here is there are four SNP markers for each loci, and the one on chromosome 1 is showing you the location, SNP name, and then the allele predictions. from susceptible and resistant, and likewise for locust 6. Here is average ECHAP scores for the different allelic makeup of individuals in Dr. Clark's program. So here is the locus on G1. As you can see, RR was significantly different from susceptible, and we did see the intermediates were different as well. And here's a representation of the allele frequencies in his program. G6, he has pretty much fixed, which is exciting. It was exciting to see with resistant alleles. And so the reason this is so broad is because that is just showing the amount of individuals that were used, or that are that genotype. So the next thing is to incorporate seedling selection. And here's crossing plan of Dr. Clark's. So here's one cross and another cross, the two parents, and then showing their genotypes here. And so as what you can see is that G6 for both of these parents, he already has fixed. So 100% of the seedlings are still going to be RR. The idea was then to try to fix the G1 locus. And so there's about a 20 base pair difference between the the alleles. Resistant allele is about 300, susceptible about 320. So we planted 75% of the seedlings and culled 25% of the seedlings with the susceptible. Here's just a representation of the greenhouse organizational system. This is from Washington State apple breeding program. But we're just going and learning from them. And so breeding is a numbers game, right? The more crosses, the higher the chance of a seedling inheriting the optimal package of alleles for key traits. So that's why seedling selection is important. Next, with the phenotypic data I took, we then did pedigree-based QTL analysis. I have just some preliminary results at this point, but they are very exciting. So the idea of PBA is to identify additional QTL. Why use PBA? Well, biparental QTL analysis approaches might not have identified all the QTL loci responsible for ECHAP resistance. And multiple segregating populations increases the genetic background, which enhances the ability to identify other important QTL. 7 F1 populations were used. The Arkansas isolate mix and the North Carolina XF88 were also used separately in analysis. And we have great preliminary results. The G1 was identified, and so that further confirms that locus is important. Also, the G6 was not identified, which is very interesting to see and makes sense because he has that locus fixed. Then on G5, Dr. Gosick had identified a QTL there for both leaf and fruit, and it was also identified in apricot as well on G5. So that will be an interesting one to haplotype and work with. Also, a few others on a different chromosomes. So the ultimate goal is to use MAB for except leaf and fruit resistant as a tool to introduce horizontal resistant. That's why we're going after other QTLs, because at this point we just have 2 that are for fruit resistance. So we would like to get some QTLs for leaf resistance as well. Well, thank you very much, and questions?
Thank you very much. Time is up, but since he's last, you can ask any questions. That means it'll take time away from your lunch date. Any questions for Terrence? Okay, yes.
Yes, sir.
Sorry. When you were working on back in the fruits and the leaves, did you see that the plants that were resistant for fruit?
Well, it was a case-by-case basis, but yes, there was clear evidence that sometimes individuals were resistant for the leaves, yet not for the fruit, and vice versa. Yep.
Okay, well, thank you, Terrence, and please thank all the speakers for their wonderful presentations. Thanks, Terrence. Thank you.